change our dish and try a little fish instead.
Everybody.
Catfish for supper. First one thing and another. Catfish for supper. First one thing and then another.
This is WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored Back Porch Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. That's right, Stuart. It's WORT Madison. Bye-bye.
Last night, we had breakfast. Change our dish
and try a little fish instead. Catfish for supper. First one thing, then another. Catfish.
Hello, I'm Govinda Gill with the BBC News. The sell-off on global stock markets has deepened as investors fear a looming global trade war triggered by Donald Trump's announcement of wide-ranging tariffs. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones has fallen by more than 3.5%, compounding similar losses suffered on Thursday. The head of the US Central Bank, Jerome Powell, said the levies on imports were bigger than anticipated.
We have stressed that it will be very difficult to assess the likely economic effects of higher tariffs until there is greater certainty about the details, such as what will be tariffed, at what level and for what duration, and the extent of any retaliation from our trading partners. While uncertainty remains elevated, it is now becoming clear that tariff increases will be significantly larger than expected, and the same is likely to be true of the economic effects, which will include higher inflation and slower growth. The size and duration of these effects remains uncertain.
China's announced retaliation against the United States for the tariffs imposed by Donald Trump. Mr. Trump said the government in Beijing had panicked. The measures include an additional 34% levy on all imports from the US. The move mirrors the tariffs announced by Mr. Trump on Wednesday. From Beijing, Stephen McDonnell reports.
The Chinese government announced its promised resolute countermeasures in a written statement, which was also broadcast on the evening news during the Qingming Festival holiday. There's speculation that the timing could have been to minimise the impact of such bad news, but it might also show that Beijing simply realised that a deal with Washington was not coming soon. China was also restricting the export of 7 rare earth elements, crucial in the production of consumer electronics. However, the spectacle of the planet's two biggest economies at each other's throats is what worries many economists.
The US Secretary of State says Mr. Trump will not fall into the trap of endless negotiations with Russia over ending the war in Ukraine, and Washington will judge Moscow by its actions, not its words. Marco Rubio was speaking after a NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels.
We will know soon enough, in a matter of weeks, not months, whether Russia is serious about peace or not. I hope they are. It would be good for the world if that war ended. But obviously, we have to test that proposition. So we're working through that process.
Mr. Rubio's remarks come amid growing disquiet in Ukraine and among European leaders about what they view as delaying tactics by President Putin. Ukrainian officials say at least 12 people have been killed in a Russian ballistic missile strike on a residential area of Kryvyi Rih. The head of the Dnipropetrovsk region said 3 were children. The city's mayor said more than 50 people had been injured. Kryvyi Rih is President Zelensky's home city. World news from the BBC. Bangladesh says Myanmar has confirmed 180,000 Rohingya refugees eligible for repatriation. The announcement followed talks in Bangkok and is a major step towards resolving the long-standing refugee crisis. Here's Electra Naismith.
This is the first time that Rohingya eligible for return to Myanmar have been confirmed. There are still obstacles, but it's an important step forward. The refugees that have been verified are part of a list provided by Bangladesh in batches between 2018 and 2020. Dhaka says Myanmar has pledged to verify the remaining 500,000 names on that list expeditiously. Bangladesh hosts more than 1 million Muslim Rohingya. They're a persecuted minority in Myanmar, denied basic rights, insists citizenship. Early attempts at returning the refugees failed because they refused to go back, fearing the same violence they'd fled.
Israeli and Turkish officials have said they are not seeking conflict with each other in Syria following tensions between them over Israeli airstrikes and what the IDF says are Syrian military sites. Turkey's foreign minister, however, said Israel was paving the way for instability in the region by destroying important security sites in Syria. There have been reports Turkey was hoping to deploy its forces in some of the bases Israel struck. The British comedian and actor Russell Brand has been charged with 5 sexual offences against 4 women, including rape. The incidents are alleged to have happened between 1999 and 2005. Brand has been ordered to appear before a court in May. He's previously denied any wrongdoing. Football now, and the Manchester City captain Kevin De Bruyne has announced he will leave the English Premier League club at the end of the season. The 33-year-old is seen as one of the club's greatest ever players, winning 16 major trophies since joining 10 years ago. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative. Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to
no place. No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am STD Noor. We're doing something different today, no long form. We have several short interviews that are not about Trump or Musk or Netanyahu or the rest of them. Today we are doing a Wisconsin Film Festival show, and in the studio with us is our first interviewee, Tim Hunter. He's an American television and film director. His 1986 film River's Edge won the 1986 award for Best Picture at the Independent Spirit Award. He has several films at the festival this year. Tex will air Saturday at 4 p.m. at the UW Cinematheque. His narrative film, Returning to Earth, will play Sunday at 4 p.m. And his documentary by Kevin Thomas will play on Sunday at 3:30. Here's a clip from by Kevin Thomas, which is basically a long interview with the film critic who has written reviews for the Los Angeles Times starting in 1962. He is the longest running film critic among major United States newspapers.
All I ever did was to simply express my feelings about what I had seen, keeping it simple. I didn't have any agenda or any, I was a free spirit. I did interview a lot of really interesting people over the years.
And hi, Tim. Good to have you in the studio. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Yeah, so unfortunately, that was the only film of yours that I was able to watch, but it is... It's a very interesting long interview. Did you do it all in one day?
We did it in 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
We shot over 2 successive Saturdays, and we had 2 cameras on the shoot, so that we could cut out the pauses.
Yeah.
And keep the thing moving.
Yeah, that's what I noticed. He knew enough to wear the same clothes the second day.
Yes.
Yeah. So, again, it's very interesting. When did he retire? Do you remember?
Kevin retired, I don't exactly remember, but he retired whenever Manola Dargis took over the role of the first string critic at the LA Times. Kevin was the second string critic for all those years, for 40 years. So he worked under a number of critics, initially Charles Champlin, then Sheila Benson, then Kenny Turan, and then Manola Dargis. So he was in an ideal position being the second stringer because he got to review all the independent films, the foreign films, the exploitation films, the low-budget films. And Kevin was a guy who, when he was writing, people felt that Kevin was often too kind to films, but I just feel that Kevin always found the heart of what was good about any film, even if the film wasn't entirely good in its totality, and that's what he would just write about. He was an enormous film enthusiast, and if you look back at the body of his writing, which I was able to do through the voluminous scrapbooks that he kept of all his articles and reviews over the 40-year period, he was really a very good writer. It was not just Entertainment Tonight puff pieces. He knew film and knew how to appreciate it. And, of course, he was there at a wonderful period in film history because he could interview the birth of the new American filmmakers who came of age in the 70s. The French New Wave that started in the 60s and led to so much change in filmmaking, and he also had a foot in Hollywood's golden age, and the older film stars in the older films, which he would review when they were revived. So he really had a terrific run.
Mm-hmm. So one thing interesting about him that he's gay. And when he started working there, being gay was not, I mean, it's Hollywood, right? So it's a different story. But he was talking about how during his entire time, basically people did not attack him, he didn't have to pay for being gay. And he talks about how Cukor was, who was also gay, was, it sounded like kind of the, I don't know, the father of the, or, you know, the guy, the mentor, I think he says, who helped people who were gay at the time when it was totally not cool to be gay, to be themselves.
Yeah, George Cukor was one of his mentors from the golden age of Hollywood cinema. Cukor, of course, was the director of Camille, The Philadelphia Story, Holiday, Adam's Rib, many of the Hepburn Tracy movies, right up through the film of My Fair Lady. And Cukor was a gay man, and everybody knew he was a gay man, but he never officially came out of the closet. Kevin became close to him, and Cukor mentored him, and apparently many other gay people in Hollywood were helped by Cukor. There must be more stuff on this in biographies of Cukor, but Kevin does talk about him with great affection for the example that he set. And yeah, it's quite amazing that at the 40 years at the LA Times, he never had to deal with any anti-gay prejudice or any prejudice of any kind. He just says it never became an issue. He says he was just himself and he was accepted, and that it was a testament to the quality of the LA Times, not a very good paper at this point, but back then, certainly one of the major newspapers in the country.
Yeah, I mean, you said earlier that it was the golden age for Hollywood, but when you said that, I also thought it was also a golden age for newspapers, which is not the case anymore.
No.
Yeah, do you know film critics that you really appreciate nowadays? Well, Manolo Dargis is still writing, correct? Or am I wrong or not?
You've hit me on a sore point because
you don't
except for some of the European critics who write more analytical stuff. There may still be good writing in Sight and Sound, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But my own feeling is that, and it oddly wasn't true of Kevin, perhaps because he was a second string critic and got to review all the marginal stuff, which made it more fun. But many film critics, in my opinion, just hang on too long. And when they do that, they tend to like stuff too much and become less critical. Or they anyway. I'm not too fond of the state of film criticism at the moment.
Yeah. Well, we have our next guest, but let me ask you at least one more question. Fritz Lang. He talks a lot about Fritz Lang and his partner Lily Latte and Joan Bennett. And Fritz Lang and Lily were both, they escaped from Nazi Germany. It's a big, important story, but tell us briefly what Kevin says in the film.
Well, the story of Fritz Lang leaving Germany is pretty fabled. He was asked by Goebbels to become the Nazi minister of film, and that was his cue to flee as fast as possible. He made a film called The Testament of Dr. Mabuse about a master criminal that was ultimately banned by the Nazis because they saw it as a metaphor for against fascism. Lang left his first wife behind in Germany, the writer Thea von Harbou, who collaborated with him on Metropolis and a bunch of other pictures. And his companion became Lily Latte, this wonderful woman who stayed with him throughout his life. And they were highly cultured people, coming from Germany and being part of the German emigre community in Hollywood at that time. And, you know, Lang had a reputation for being a pretty hard taskmaster, but what Kevin says about him, and it was true in my own experience with Fritz Lang because I knew him as a young filmmaker, some is that he was a very warm-hearted guy, very loving. And people talk about Lang's films in terms of their fatalism, their determinism, their larger, you know,
themes. The themes.
But Lang himself was more concerned with the emotions of his characters and how people felt. And so Lang the man was somewhat different from people's perception of Lang the filmmaker, and I think that comes out in what Kevin says about him. I will cede this to my colleague here, but will say that if anything in this film, which is basically a straight mini oral history interview with Kevin, I slanted it a bit more toward Lang than he might have possibly done on his own, because as I say, I knew Lang and I loved him also, and I just thought nobody appreciated Lily Latte, who stayed with him all those years, and thought maybe we could get some of that out. Anyway, thank you,
and if you're a cinephile, this is the movie for you. A history of partial, but quite lengthy history of Hollywood.
48
What I meant is 62 to like 80 something or 90 something. Yeah, 48 minutes too. Thank you so much, Tim Hunter.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And with us now in the studio is Greg Gliena, the American director and screenwriter from Chicago, most known as the creator of the 1992 film Meet the Parents. It's the original screenplay that would eventually become the 2000 blockbuster starring Ben Stiller. The original version features a cameo from Emo Phillips. The film screens tomorrow Saturday at 1 p.m. at the Barrymore Theater. Hi, Glenn. Greg.
Don't worry,
Greg,
I've gotten that my whole life. My last name becomes my first name.
Yeah, it's kind of,
it's... Hello, well, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and you kind of still look the same.
Well, you know, it's only been
20 years,
3 decades.
20-some years, yeah. But yeah, you...
I try not to age, so I think...
You're recognizable. Let's hear a quick clip from the film and get back to the interview.
Excuse me, do you work here?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen this film, The Country Doctor, with Andy Griffith and Sandy Duncan?
The Country Doctor? That's my favorite.
Would you say this is a good family film? You know, one you could watch with the whole family?
Are you kidding? Our family watches it all the time. It's really brought us together.
Oh, great, thanks. This guy here says it's a good family film. I think we should get it.
Okay, whatever.
Excuse me, is this a good movie?
Ishtar, that's my favorite.
Of all the clips to show, that's the an odd choice.
Why do you think? I did not choose it, but why do you think so?
Well, it's not a big gag, you know. It's a setup to a gag.
Yeah.
But you know what's funny? I was trying to think of what in the film is dated, and that's one of the things. Kids are going to be going, what is that room with all the boxes?
Oh, yeah. <You know? laughs> A video store, right?
Yeah, you know.
Right. But yeah, what comes before that and what comes after that is entertaining in a kind of hurtful way.
I think so.
I would say, yeah. So that was Emo Phillips, who also wrote the title theme song and was an associate professor on the film. So how did you come to make the film? You're a guy from Chicago. Was that your first film?
Yes. Well, I'd done a lot of shorts.
Mm-hmm.
But I did a short called The Vase. And it was about a guy who goes to meet his girlfriend's parents. It's 5 minutes long. And I break this vase, the prize vase.
Okay. That sounds familiar.
So I had this idea. I was inspired by the movie The Party with Peter Sellers. And I don't know if you saw that, but the entire...
So many Peter Sellers movies. And,
yeah, the entire plot is basically he goes to a Hollywood party and ruins it. That's the whole, you know. So I thought, why couldn't you do a feature where he goes to meet his girlfriend's parents and everything just goes wrong, you know? So I used to be a stand-up comedian, and I got to know Emo Phillips from opening up for him in comedy clubs. And I told him I had this idea, and he said, you know, that could be really funny. We said, why don't you write it? And then if I like it, I'll consider putting money into it. He was doing very well at the time. And so I wrote it with a girl named Mary Ruth Clark, because I'd never written a screenplay, and she had written some plays. And he put the money up, and that's how it got made. It ended up being seen by Steven Soderbergh, and he brought it into Universal and said...
Oh, really?
Yeah, he said, this should be... He called me and said, This should be a Hollywood movie. Everyone in the world can relate to this premise, you know.
And it became eventually.
Yeah, he was right.
Yeah. So you are from Chicago, as we said. You're a Midwesterner, even though Chicago is somewhat different. But basically, it's to a large degree, for me anyway, who's not from the Midwest originally, but who has been living here for a long time, it's about being nice. Smiling like I'm smiling at you right now while holding a knife behind your back kind
of
thing.
Oh, that's your impression of Chicago?
No, of the Midwest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I said. You're different because you're from Chicago, but there's all these places where they say, oh, it's okay, it's fine, and they have this forced smile, or it could happen to anyone, and not actually refusing to talk about anything, which is what...
Maybe you've just met the wrong people.
No,
of course, I've been living in L.A. for 20 years. So.
Okay, so you don't even know what I'm talking about, maybe anymore.
Those people seem great compared to L.A.
Yeah, I spent some time in L.A. too, and I moved to the Midwest, actually. But yeah, okay, so to me, this seemed to be one of the themes there is that... I don't know, that way of behaving, like everything is okay,
right,
and
right.
We should keep smiling right. While everything is falling apart.
But that's a different, your daughter's going to marry this guy. You'd try at least to get along and be pleasant.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they are kind of pleasant in that Midwestern way.
Yeah. Until they're pushed over the edge, basically. But.
Yeah, yeah. So... So what do you think of the later remakes, other than what you just said?
The sequels, you mean, or the...
The big remakes.
Oh, I thought it was good. They took everything and just blew it up and made it everything... You know, mine, he overflows the toilet, and that one, the whole yard septic tank gets flooded. But I liked... Meet the Fockers. I didn't think there was any reason to make Little Fockers.
The Fockers. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, Jim Carrey added that?
No.
Yeah. He was going to play Greg for a while, and one of his suggestions was the Focker name.
Uh-huh. So do you still make these kinds of movies now? Are you still doing funny...
Yeah, well...
Hurdy movies, or...
That was an experiment. You know, I was a big fan of Laurel and Hardy, and so was Emo Phillips, and we used to talk about, and Chaplin and Buster Keaton, and I was trying to make a comedy with no jokes. You know, and if you look at it, there's no one's trying to be funny. You know, they may say things that get a laugh, but no one's attempting to be funny.
Right.
It was like an experiment, actually. It was like a... You know, I wanted to make a movie that it wasn't joke related. You know, it was the situations that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Greg remains kind of stone faced throughout, and except you can see that he's getting devastated more and more by the minute.
Right.
So this is still Faye, who is your co-writer, Mary Ruth Clark.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she was very good. I also thought when she finally sings, Greg doesn't like it, but there was something very...
You like her singing.
You know, I like crazy music, maybe.
Well, you know, I wrote that song that she sang, and that was me playing the piano on the...
Oh, it was you.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
It actually, towards the end, it gets really heartrending in a sense.
I think you're the only person who thinks that.
Yeah.
But, no, we...
I seem to be interpreting your movie in a different way.
Yeah, well, that's great. But we did that film in one take. That whole song, we had one roll of film, and we had to just do it. And I told her just... It's pretend you're on stage. If you make a mistake, you have to just cover for. And she did that all brilliantly, that whole song and the breakdown, all
brilliant.
In one take. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What has she been doing since?
She's been writing plays, and she teaches writing in Chicago.
Uh-huh. So she's not in movies?
No, I mean, when this went into production, I moved to Los Angeles, and she stayed here. And
yeah.
You know, it's better to move to Los Angeles.
If you want to make movies.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I used to be in the film industry too, and but not since I've arrived here. Well, we have 1 minute left, so what do you want to say?
The film is playing at 1 o'clock tomorrow at the Barrymore Theater, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big theater.
Yeah, it's a big theater, so come in.
It will be quite full.
It'll be very funny with an you know, it's so great to see these with an audience, with comedies, because it's such a different experience than watching it on your phone or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So I hope hopefully people will come out and laugh.
Yeah. Are you happy to be back in the Midwest?
I am. I love it here.
Yeah. Have you been to Madison before?
Yeah, I used to do stand-up comedy, so I used to work here all the time.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And, yeah. Thanks. That was Greg Gliena. I got your name correct right now. The screenwriter and director of Meet the Parents. Thanks, Greg. And we are going to go again. Oh, no. We have actually a ticket giveaway right now. Be the first to call 608-256-2001 and you'll get two vouchers for the festival, which is running through next Thursday. We have a pair of tickets for you. These vouchers are redeemable for any film that hasn't sold out. You need to come pick them up today during business hours or wait until Monday to get them then. 608-256-2001. And on the phone with us is... I'm assuming that the name is Catherine Leger. Is that correct?
Or is That's it perfect. Hi. Catherine Leger, yeah.
Catherine Leger, yeah. And Catherine writes for film, TV, and theater. Her screenplay for Charlotte Dufan won her the Best Original Screenplay Award at the 2019 Canadian Screens. She joins us by phone from Montreal today. And her film, Two Women, is showing on Sunday, April 6th at 7 p.m. at Union South. And then again on Thursday, April 10 at 5:45 at Flicks Brewhouse. Let's hear a quick clip and we'll be back with Catherine.
Je comprends pas ta réaction.
Quoi, j'ai pas de réaction?
Et justement, on dirait que tu t'en fous.
On peut être ensemble, c'est juste que je suis pas en amour avec toi.
Mais de quoi tu parles? On est fous l'un de l'autre.
Je te trouve pas beau.
Yeah, so for people who don't speak French, that still sounds very French, like French movie, Catherine. The film is about two women who are next door neighbor, Florence and Violette, who are both unhappy in their marriages. They begin a series of affairs with handymen and delivery men at their Quebec apartment complex. In the scene that we heard, the lover of one of the husbands tells him that she doesn't find him attractive and they would not end up together. Catherine, I love the film. It is a remake of Claude Fournier's film from 1970, which was titled Two Women in Gold. How is it different, and why did you want to write a new version?
I'm actually a big fan of that original movie because it was really impressive that in the 70s they would do a movie about two women who would emancipate and find their freedom and sexually without being punished in the end. And it was like a comedy. It was really light. And even in today's fiction world, it's hard to find movies who can actually talk about women's sexuality in a comedy. So for me, it was really inspiring and I wanted to do it in set place in 2024.
Uh-huh. And what is new about it and different from the original?
Well, the original was from like a stay-at-home wife, which was like in the 70s. That was like basic life for women. So now, like, I didn't want to do a stay-at-home wife or like it wouldn't make sense today because it's pretty rare. Like women work these days. But even though they do have a career and they have more freedom than they used to have in the 70s, there's still something unfulfilled. And I guess that's what I wanted to explore, like this pressure that women have to like always do the right thing, always make the right decisions. And I think these characters are just looking for a way to like stop stop being this perfect version of themselves, which is exhausting and not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they are really doing it together. They're helping each other emancipate, as you would say. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that the fact that they can like have this friendship that makes them stronger and less scared to lose what they have, because basically that's what we're all scared. We're scared to lose something, and we just don't move. We don't take any risk. We don't make any decision. Which for one of the characters, the decision that she needs to do is to maybe step away from her marriage and start a new life of her own.
Yeah. So I wonder, one of the reviewers who is mentioned in the festival's booklet says that the film feels plucked from Woody Allen's finest work. How do you feel about that, Woody Allen, of all people?
Well, I think, you know, like it's hard to like the minute like you have these like a bit like neurotic characters that talk a bit and over analyze everything and it come in a funny way, it's like Woody Allen will come to mind. So like I think I don't have an opinion on that. It's kind of flattering, but I understand that like this is what it is. Like it's a comedy of people who are making wrong decisions and like are discussing it and are thinking about it. So the comedy comes a lot from the dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's the relationships are interesting, and there's one sentence that really caught my attention, and that's when actually the husbands are talking. They become friends once they start realizing that the women are quite unsatisfied and unhappy. And one of them says to the other, yes, there's no rush to live your life. There's time. Talk about that.
Oh, that's funny you even mentioned that. I like that line. I think it's just he's trying to resist this pressure to accomplish something, or like he just wants to have a quiet life, and he feels like the pressure is coming from his wife, where she's the one who's gonna first like raise her hand and say this is not working anymore, and he doesn't want to hear it. So I think he's kind of like at this point in the movie, he just wants everything to stop and like have a break and like don't have to make like important decisions. And he's telling it to his friend, but he wants to say it to his wife.
Yeah, and that's while, of course, the wives are like, no, I need to live a life. I can't just stay in this position of nothingness.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like it's the both women are both mothers, and I think that's really an important part of the movie. How like, you know, even like younger, like well, I was a feminist. I'm still a feminist. I was a rebel. I didn't think I needed to conform myself to any norm. And then like I became a mother, and being a mother made me. Like I became so normal because I felt that was what was needed for the baby. So I became really obsessed with like doing the right thing and like making the right food. And like, you know, it just changed you. And then at some point the kids get older and they don't need you as much. And then you're like, well, who am I? And how is this working? And like, I think this is a really important, part of the both characters. It's like they're coming back from motherhood, and then they're like, do I still have time to live my life, and how am I going to do that? And of course it's a comedy, so they don't do the right thing right away, right? They need to do detours, they need to like make some bad decisions before they make the right ones.
It's interesting that, of course, or you know, maybe it's obvious that the women are unhappy and the men are also unhappy in these relationships, but they don't do all the talking that women are doing, which helps them change. And also, a lot goes untold and undiscussed between the couples. And, you know, as I was watching that, I was wondering what you think. Would discussing things, would talking more, would that be the secret for a satisfying relationship?
Well, I think we could, like, one of the couple, we can imagine that they will talk more and they will fix their relationship. I think, like, and for the other one, I think it was just over, maybe, like, it was hard for, they were coming from a harder place, but it's more about, like, it's more about the journey for them to just accept that they're not perfect, and they won't, like, succeed. Their life won't be perfect. They might not have the perfect relationship, and that's what I wanted to leave the audience with. It's not more about, like, how do you save your relationship. It's more about, like, if you're in a hard place in your relationship right now, it's fine. It happens. It's normal.
Yeah, yeah. So we have very little time left, but I wanted to ask you about being a screenwriter and how that works. Do you usually write a screenplay and then you pitch it to directors, or is it the other way around, or do you work together? How does it usually work?
I think I will accept to work on some project when, like, a director that I want to work with will come to me and offer it to me. But, like, most of the time I initiate projects that I really want to write, which was this case with this movie. And then I try to convince the directors I really want to work with to like do it with me. And for this one, Chloé Robichaud was like, for me, it was like my first choice. I really wanted to work with her. It has been a long time. We have been looking for the right project to work together. So when I called her and told her I was working on this, and she knew the movie also, that the movie is based on, that I did the remake, and she was thrilled. So right away, we were a match for this one. And it was, I'm so happy what she did. She did an amazing work. Like, I'm really excited about this movie.
Yeah, it's really a lovely movie. So one last question about being a screenwriter. Do you spend much time on set, or do you just, is your work done when the movie starts production?
I go on set, of course. I like a set is is a really stressful place to be. There's not a lot, like, there's a lot of action. Things are going really fast, so it's not maybe the best time to, like, keep doing my job as a screenwriter. Mostly, like, I'm there for the meetings first, and we discuss everything a lot before we actually start shooting. But during shooting, I'm there because it's fun, it's exciting, but, like, then it's really for the director to do her job. I'm also producer on this one, so I kind of, like, I follow the movie from the start till the end, you know, discussing, like, all the promo, all the so it's kind of, I like to be there.
Yeah. Well, Catherine Legere, who wrote the screenplay for Two Women, which is showing on Sunday, April 6th at 7 p.m. at Union South, and Thursday, April 10th at 5:45 at Flicks Brewhouse. She joined us from Montreal. Thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Bye-bye. And
bye-bye.
If you want to get a pair of tickets and you didn't the first time, 608-256-2001, you'll have to come and get it either by the end of the day today or on Monday. And we are going to go now to my interview a little earlier today, because he couldn't be here at this time, with Aman Abbasi, who is the director and the co-writer of Yasmin's Element. I don't know why there's all these, why it looks like everything is deleted, but Aman Abbasi is a Pakistani-American writer, director, editor, producer, and composer from Little Rock. He's short form documentary.
Aman Abbasi is a Pakistani-American writer, director, editor, producer, and composer from Little Rock. His short-form documentary about the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake in Haiti won the DuPont Award. His film, Yasmin's Element, is screening on Sunday, April 6th at 4:15 at the Marquee at Union South. Let's hear a quick clip from the film.
वो तुमने मूवी देखा सोनिक का मैं सोनिक वो द सोनिक है जो सोनिक द है जो वो मैं मुझे बहुत पसंद है वो वैसे तेज भी होते हैं यार यास्मीन बेग तो बंद कर लो चीजें फिर
This is a clip from Yasmin's Element, a crucial point in the film when Yasmin drops her homework, her assigned periodic element, while running. In that clip, she's also talking about liking Sonic the Hedgehog before her friend warns her to zip her bag. Things will fall out. A crucial bit of foreshadowing. Aman, thank you so much for coming in. I loved the film. It's in a very pretty settings. The mountains play a big role in the film. Is this the Karakoram mountain range?
Hey, Esty, thank you for having me. Yes, it is actually the Karakoram mountain range. It's the Himalayan system that's in the northern region of Pakistan, Hunza Valley, to be specific, in the town that we filmed in. Gulmit. And, you know, we were there for several weeks filming the Yasmin's Element.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that a lot of the actors are actually local people. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, everyone in the film is from that village of Gulmit.
That includes Yasmin?
That includes the character Yasmin, who's Ishal Fatima, is the actor.
Uh-huh. And so Yasmin is a bossy girl. She is courageous, determined,
right.
Also very well-mannered.
Yeah.
Different from what we think about Pakistan and the role of women there. Talk about that.
You know, Yasmin is a rambunctious individual, very studious, very driven, and one who wants to be able to get her assignment done. And that is her mission from the get-go. And obviously in the film, there's a lot of things that get in her way and a lot of people that get in her way. And so it shows the obstacles and the opportunities that are presented to Yasmin over the course of this one day as she searches for a professor.
Yeah. And again, I think we tend to think of women in Pakistan as not very free to be themselves. And I don't know if that's a correct perception, but certainly Yasmin is not that kind of girl.
She certainly goes against stereotype, and so much of the film is to go against quote-unquote stereotype, beyond just the stereotypes of women there, but also just showing the natural beauty of Pakistan. So many people, believe Pakistan is this place that's uneducated, where, it's so impoverished. And now, while there are social critiques to be made of Pakistan, and the film does do that, I also wanted to celebrate the rich culture and the beautiful people and the beautiful land. And so much of that is in the film. So presenting it in that sort of dichotomy, the challenges ahead for Yasmin and those in the specific school, but also the richness of the culture.
Yeah. So you wrote the screenplay also. What made you think of this particular screenplay, this particular story?
So I co-wrote it with Jeff Stern, a journalist, as well as Sana Jaffrey, the producer on the film. And we co-wrote this together in a sort of fable-like allegorical story. You know, I knew I've always wanted to make a film in Pakistan, and specifically those that revolve around teachers, because my mom started her career as a teacher in Pakistan. So that's like sort of the direct piece of inspiration. Then later on, some years ago, I read Jeff Stern's book, The Last Thousand, which deals with a school in Afghanistan called Marifat, and the beauty that it possesses and the education that the students get. But, you know, it faced a lot of adversity. And so looking at that as a starting point for Yasmin's Element, that's how we started to write it. And instead of getting into the geopolitics of the region or anything of that nature, I wanted it to be a story that sort of looks at the challenge through the young person's eyes, because whose affected is Yasmin and her fellows.
Yeah, and it's true that you don't get into the geopolitics, but you do get a little bit, at least, into what it means to live on a border. Talk about that, if you will.
Yeah, like the school that she attends clearly is in some existential crisis.
Yeah.
And we keep it vague. We keep it vague because it's oftentimes, for spontaneous reasons, a school may close in the region. And that's always the sort of existential anxiety of a school, too, because you may not know for what reason or why. And then beyond that, also, the young person is oftentimes the last person to know. And I wanted it to centralize around those anxieties and existential threats as one tries to gain that education itself.
Well, I think we have very little time left. Is there anything else you want our listeners to know about the film?
Well, we're playing in Madison on Sunday at 4:15 at the Marquee. And this is my first time in Madison. I'm so happy to be here. I'll be doing a Q&A afterwards. This has been a labor of love that we made in northern Pakistan. So it's with a great pleasure and gratitude to be bringing it to the city. I'd love to see you all.
Yeah. Do you think you'll make more films in Pakistan?
I would love to. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Aman Abbasi, Pakistani-American writer, director, editor, producer, and composer from Little Rock, we were talking about his film that I really loved, Yasmin's Element. Thank you so much, Aman, for joining us today.
Esti, thank you so much.
And we have one last ticket giveaway, 608-256-2001. Be the first, and you can get a pair of vouchers for the film festival. With me is our last guest for today. Mike King is the senior programmer for the Wisconsin Film Festival. He also curates UW Cinematheque's seasonal series and heads up the Spotlight Cinema at the Madison Museum of Community Art. He joins me now to discuss the festival. Hi, Mike. Thank you for joining us. We don't have much time, but tell us about the process of curating the festival, and also what year is it?
Well, thank you so much for having me. Mm-hmm. This is the 27th Wisconsin 27th. Film Festival, so it's been going on for a while, still going strong. We had an amazing opening night last night, still many movies to come. And as far as curating the festival, it really is like a year-long process. Myself and Jim Healy attend other festivals throughout the year. I started programming for this festival in May at Cannes last year. There's movies that I saw there that are in this festival, so I'll be going there in a few weeks, and I'll start looking for next year's edition. Then we attend Toronto and Sundance and other festivals like that. We also get a lot of screeners sent to us from filmmakers we know, distributors we know. So it's a really long process of just assembling, seeing all that's out there, and finding the films that we think Madison would really respond to.
Yeah, so you and Jim have maybe the best jobs on campus.
Feels that way sometimes, yes.
Yeah, I you know, when I was the artistic director of the Madison World Music Festival, I got to do things like that too, and that was the best part of my job. So how do you choose the films? Do you think ahead of time that you want specific things? Do you have any themes, or what are the criteria?
Well, I would say that one of the things that's so great about this festival is that we really program from the films that we're passionate about. We don't go in with many preconceptions. Our eyes are wide open when we attend these other festivals, and we let what is available to us guide what is in the festival. And we often find connections between the films or resonances through what we're excited about. So it really, we don't go in looking for certain things. We are just looking for the films that excite us, that surprise us, that get us excited and invigorated about filmmaking, the films that make us say, this is the kind of movie you have to see in a theater with a crowd. This is going to be a special event.
Mm-hmm. What about the old movies? How are they part of the picture?
Absolutely. This is a crucial part of our festival. And it's a part, I think, that distinguishes us from a lot of other film festivals, that we have so many repertory selections. We really focus on that just as much. We have a lot of brand new restorations. So we're very, you know, Jim Healy, who programs the Cinematheque, is very in tune with what the latest restorations are. We bring archivists to the festival who will be presenting these films. So they're showing their work, you know, that is like freshly restored. And then, you know, sometimes we'll be inspired to just something that we've seen that we, or think films that we've been trying to make happen, personal favorites. So we really do try and make the repertory selections just as important as the new films. And in fact, I think you could go to the festival every single screening and only see films from the past.
Yeah, yeah. And I had one of these archivists on the show last year.
Great.
I think she's back here this year, no?
Well, we have a lot of returning visitors,
yeah.
So it's entirely possible.
Yeah. And how does that work? Do you invite them? Do they decide to come?
We all of our guests are invited. They're, you know, we invite the people that we are excited about the work that they're doing. So like Rita Belda from Sony is a regular guest. She always brings these amazing restorations to us, and Jim works with her to see what is the latest things that they're excited about bringing. We invite the archivists just like we invite the filmmakers, the people who we think are doing exciting, vital work in cinema.
Yeah. So do both of you see all the movies, or you trust each other's taste? Or?
Well, we trust each other. In fact, one of the pleasures of the festival is often that we are in constant communication about these movies. Some of them we both see, but a lot of it, you know, we just explain to each other what we're up to, and then it's nice to be able to, you know, trust somebody and rely on somebody so much like that.
Yeah.
And then I'll get to watch some of his picks, he'll get to watch some of mine.
During the festival.
Yeah. And of course, we also have our Wisconsin Zone section, which is headed up by Ben Reiser, and our Big Screens Little Folks section with Terry Kerr. So there are other components of the festival that are programmed by really great teams as well.
So tell us about the Wisconsin Choice this year, and I don't know if you've seen any of it, but...
Oh, sure.
So what are you excited about?
Well, we had our Golden Badgers Awards last night. These are the films that we bring in a jury who watches all of the Wisconsin Zone films, and these are the only films in the festival that are actually submitted to us, films that have connections to Wisconsin. And we presented the awards last night at opening night, and those films will all screen. They're in shorts programs throughout the weekend. One film that I know I'm excited about is a movie called Lifers, which is a concert film by this band Local H, and the singer of that band is going to perform live at the screening, and it's going to be a really fun, like, rockin' night at Music Hall on Sunday night.
Oh, that is exciting. Yeah. By the way, I missed my first movie, which was at Music Hall at 11. I somehow didn't notice when I...
Well, there's plenty more screenings coming up. I hope you can make it to some.
Yeah, I hope so, too. 30 seconds. What would you like our listeners to hear?
Well, I would just say, you know, this is a really great chance for everyone in Madison to come see movies together on the big screen. You know, last night we showed this comedy, and it just was such a great reminder of the power of seeing films together in a room with your friends and neighbors.
Yeah, tonight I'll be at the movie whose name we cannot mention.
Oh, great.
Thank you, Mike King, and thanks to all the people who worked on this show today, Sarah and Summer and Shelly, and we'll be back to this long form next week. I'm STD Noor. Bye-bye. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. You're listening to WORT Madison. Recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Ah, I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good, so good. I got a year. Wow, I feel nice. A sugar and spice. Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Mel and Floyd Summer Replacement Show. I'm Mel. And with me, as always, is Mr. Smarty Pants.
Hey, today's a special day, Mel.
It is.
It's our Wisconsin Film Festival broadcast live from, where are we? Oh, yeah, the WRT Studios on Bedford Street.
That's right. We're keeping Estee's momentum going. That's Estmentum.
The Estmentum? The Estee on crack show? Yep.
She's not on crack.
Oh, okay.
So Wisconsin Film Fest Spectacular. The festival kicked off last night and runs through next Thursday, April 10th.
This year, the Film Fest boasts more than 100 film screenings at 7 different locations. Listen up, people. Here are the locations. The Bartell Theater, the Chase Museum of Art, UW Cinematheque, Music Hall, Union South, Barrymore Theater, and Flicks Brewhouse.
And I've got a sheet up in my backyard. I'm showing the...
Excellent. We're there.
Killed Pussycat Kill, I think, is tonight's showing.
All right, very good.
Tonight in the show, we'll be joined by five folks with film screaming at the festival.
One of them does, yes.
That's coming up soon, yeah.